Luke 23:50-24:12, the 88th talk in a series entitled The Gospel of Luke, was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 21, 2008, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Well, we're in the Gospel of Luke, and I just simply want to continue in the Gospel of Luke, which presents a sort of a problem that I have to solve to begin with. That is, we're at the account where we are discussing the discovery of the empty tomb by the women. So to teach on that sounds more like Easter than Christmas. So I have to rationalize why this is a Christmas message here to start with. And particularly, what I want to do is talk about some technicalities here. It may seem like technicalities have nothing to do with the heart and essence of our faith, but I don't think that's true. Technicalities erode many people's faith, and therefore looking at those same technicalities can fortify our faith, and I'm hoping that that's what we'll do this morning. If you imagine a group of people on a Sunday morning getting together to read together the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and to discuss the various predictions and prophecies there, and to talk about the history of Middle Earth and the heroes and champions of that history, I imagine you'd think that was rather odd, pathetic, and yet that's what we're doing. Is we're looking at a story, a narrative, that's full of heroes, that's full of champions, that's full of ordinary people making mistakes, and the God who's interacting with their lives. And we contemplate the predictions and the prophecies and all of that. The difference between us doing that and a group of people doing that with respect to the Lord of the Rings is that we really believe that this actually happened. This is the story that we're a part of. This is the narrative that we're a part of. The predictions are going to come true. The history really happened. This is objective reality that we're discussing, studying, and examining. I think it's just all too often that certainly non-Christians view us as Christians as in the same way that we would look at a group of people discussing Middle Earth. They think that this is a bunch of legend and fairy tale and fiction and just stories. It may have some entertainment value. It may inspire us to certain way of living. But don't take it too seriously. It's not real. It's not objective truth. It's not objective reality. And sometimes I fear that Christians have the same perspective. We're intimidated by our culture into taking the same perspective toward our faith that they do. That we come to be entertained by it. We come to be inspired by it. We come because it's interesting and intriguing to us, but it's not like it's true. It's not like it's real. What we're going to look at this morning are the accounts of the women coming to the tomb and finding the tomb empty. And the issue is it true? Did it really happen? It's all too common out there for people to look at the Bible in general and these accounts in particular and sort of read them casually, you know, just sort of read through Matthew and read through Mark and read through Luke and read through John and kind of get the impression that, boy, they can't get their story straight. They don't know what happened. They don't know how many angels they saw. They don't know where the angel was when they saw him. They don't know what the angel said. One person has Jesus meeting the women at one place and another place, that these are hopelessly confused accounts. So they conclude from that we're not dealing with actual events. We're not dealing with what really happened. We're just dealing with stories and legends. And because they come to the conclusion that we're dealing with stories and legends, then of course, why take it all that seriously? Even if it has some entertainment value, let's not actually base our life on it as if it were objective reality. So what I want to look at this morning is a way of reconciling the accounts of the women coming to the tomb, because I would like you to be persuaded that we're dealing with objective reality. We're dealing with the truth. They really did come to the tomb on that morning in the way that the accounts say that they did, and they really did find Jesus gone, raised from the dead. And because Jesus was gone and raised from the dead, we're dealing with history that is a part of the narrative of our own lives. And the fact of Jesus' resurrection has all kinds of ramifications for the objective truth, the objective reality about how we should live our lives, where we should invest our lives, and what is our ultimate destiny. And that should change everything about everything that we think and everything about everything that we do. And if it doesn't, then we're treating our faith as if it's just entertaining, as if it's just interesting and intriguing, but not as if it's true. Now, what that has to do with Christmas, now look how deft this is. What does that have to do with Christmas? Well, first of all, Jesus was the one who was born to empty that tomb. That's why he came into the world. That's why he came into the world in the way that he did. But secondly, we have the same issue and the same problem of the accounts of Jesus' birth. Are they true? Did they really happen? Are these accounts telling us what history really, what transpired in history? And my contention is yes. That my belief is that the Bible is actually totally and absolutely inerrant. There are no mistakes. There are no misstatements. There are no falsehoods in the Bible, and that we can trust it and rely upon it. But in saying that, we have to be intelligent about the way we approach the Scripture. Yes, there are no errors in it, but it doesn't mean there are no problems that have to be solved, and to spend the rest of our life contemplating, solving, coming to terms with those problems is part of the challenge, I think, of being a student of the Bible and a disciple of Jesus. So let's look at these accounts. I'm going to look at all four Gospels now, and I'll mostly be working out of the New American Standard. But let me start by giving you a reconstruction of, I think, what actually happened. Then what I want to do is go to each of the Gospels individually and show how, in fact, each of the Gospel writers has faithfully represented that picture. Somewhere around sunset, just before sunset, on a Wednesday, back in whatever year this was, Joseph of Arimathea from the Sanhedrin, we talked about him last week, he asks Pilate for the body, and he takes the body of Jesus and buries him in the tomb. Luke doesn't tell us this, but John tells us it was with Nicodemus that we know from earlier in the Gospel of John. So Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus take the body, take it to a tomb not too far away because they didn't have a lot of time. They had to get Jesus buried before sundown because after sundown was the Sabbath, and it would have been against the law for them to be working on the Sabbath. So they had to hurry to get the body buried. They take Jesus to a newly cut tomb. No body had ever been laying in that tomb. And from some sources I've looked at, that must have been expensive. Therefore, Joseph must have had a bit of money. He buys this new tomb, or has already purchased this new tomb, and he uses this tomb to lay Jesus in it. As he does so, the women who come from Galilee, we know that that includes Mary Magdalene. We know that that includes a person that various Gospels call the other Mary. And Mary Magdalene and the other Mary are often cited together. They must have been inseparable friends. So Mary Magdalene and the other Mary, who in my best judgment is Mary, the mother of Joseph and James, and that James would have been the other James of the 12 disciples, the lesser James, the less known James. That other Mary and Mary Magdalene and probably other women with them, although we don't know any of them by name, spy on Joseph and Nicodemus. They want to know where the body of Jesus is buried. And the reason they want to do that is because they want to give Jesus a proper burial when they can. Nicodemus, we are told by John, took 100 pounds of spices in order to wrap Jesus in linen and spices. What's not clear is whether the women knew that. They want to give Jesus a proper burial. It's possible that Nicodemus and Joseph did give Jesus a proper burial, but the women just couldn't tell. They're looking on from a distance. They're only really spying to find out the location of the burial. They don't really know what Joseph and Nicodemus have done to the body. Well, sundown comes after they have noticed where the location of Jesus is buried. And now we come to Thursday, well, the evening of Wednesday, and then Thursday is a Sabbath day. It's not the weekly Sabbath. It's the Sabbath, which is the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The first and last day of that feast were Sabbath days, what John calls a high Sabbath. And by that, he means a special Sabbath during a festival as opposed to a weekly Sabbath. So nobody can do nothing on that day. So they just rest on the Sabbath day as is prescribed by the law. Now comes Thursday night at the end of the Sabbath. They spend the night, and then Friday, they are now free to be up and around and work. Apparently, Mary Magdalene, the other Mary, and now we do know another name, Salome, or Salome, and perhaps other women as well, spend that day buying the spices and the cloth and preparing to getting the materials that they need to give Jesus a proper burial. Apparently, that was occupying enough that that's all that they could get accomplished on that day. But on that day, they prepare the material that they will need to bury Jesus. But alas, given the timing of this, the next day is the weekly Sabbath day. They can't do anything. So they have to rest on Saturday. Sometime after sundown on Saturday and before 6 o'clock in the morning, sometime during that time, Jesus rises from the dead. We don't know when. We're not told when. We know when the empty tomb is discovered. It's early the next morning. But Jesus actually could have raised from the dead any time during that 12-hour period. We just don't know. We do know that whenever it happened, there was some kind of earthquake, at least a localized earthquake, around the tomb. An angel of the Lord rolled the stone away and sat on the stone. That angel appeared like lightning. He was white as snow. And the guards who had been posted there by the Sanhedrin, they were terrified by the appearance of this angel and the earthquake and the rolling away of the stone. Matthew's going to tell us about that. We don't know exactly when that happened, but sometime during the night, early morning, late Saturday night or early morning. We also know that the guard then left the tomb, entered the city, reported what had happened to the chief priests, and they did that early in the morning, very early in the morning, about the same time that the women are proceeding to come to the tomb. They entered the city, reported to the chief priests what had happened, and the chief priest bribed them to spread the story that somebody came and stole, that the disciples came and stole the body of Jesus. Somewhere, right at sunrise, the women set out to go to the tomb and bury and prepare Jesus for burial. Now remember, Nicodemus took 100 pounds of spices when he and Joseph of Arimathea went to bury Jesus. I think that's significant, because although the women started off together, what appears to have happened is they split into two groups of women. The women who are unencumbered by the 100 pounds of spices that they have to carry to the tomb, and those women who are carrying the spices and are in fact encumbered by them. it only stands to reason that the women who aren't having to carry 100 pounds of spices outpace the other group of women, and they arrive at the tomb first. That group of women, we don't really know any names of them, but we do know names from other portions of the account of the women that were there during this time and were likely a part of that group. So, for example, the mother of James and John, the disciples James and John, she was probably a part of that first group of women to reach the tomb. That's the mother of the sons of Zebedee. Another woman named Joanna was very likely a part of that group. And then there were other women that we don't really know the names of. We do know names from earlier in Luke, a woman named Susanna, for example, who was a part of that group of women that supported the disciples during their ministry in Galilee. It only stands to reason that she probably was a part of that group as well. So at least those three women, and we don't know how many more, are in a group together who arrive at the tomb, find the stone rolled away, and they enter the tomb. When they enter the tomb, they see two men with dazzling clothing, and so they're called men in the account that gives us this, but those men were obviously angels in dazzling clothing. The angels tell them that Jesus is raised, that he's not dead, he's gone, and he reminds them that Jesus had predicted that. Now, this is the first group of women. This is what they experience. They then run off to tell the 11 disciples and the others that are gathered, but they're gathered in a house in Jerusalem. Remember, this tomb is outside of Jerusalem or on the outskirts of Jerusalem, so they have to go back into the city to the place where the 11 and the other disciples are located in order to tell them what they have just experienced and what they've encountered. They have left before the other women, whom they have outpaced, arrive. So the second group of women arrive at the tomb. That includes Mary Magdalene, the other Mary, and Salome, and again, perhaps other women that are unnamed, but we don't exactly know. But there are at least Mary Magdalene and the other Mary, in high probability that includes Salome, and beyond that we don't know. But those three or more women now arrive at the tomb, the other women having already had their encounter with the angels and have left. Now these other women arrive. They enter the tomb. They don't see two angels. They don't have the same experience that the first women have. They see a young man, an angel, dressed in white, sitting in the tomb. That man tells them that Jesus was raised. He shows them the empty spot where he had been laid and tells them to go tell the disciples to go to Galilee, just as he had instructed them earlier. So they then depart to tell the 11 disciples and the others that have gathered what happened. The second group of women are not that far behind the other women, so they must arrive at the house in Jerusalem shortly after the first women do. And all of the accounts tell us that the disciples there didn't believe the women. They thought this just made absolutely no sense at all. Now, I think one of the things that contributed to the fact that they didn't believe them is the women couldn't get their story straight. Was there one woman? Was there one angel? Was there two angels? What exactly happened? The various women gathered there are giving different stories. Why are they giving different stories? Because they had different experiences. They didn't have the same experience. But I think that contributed to the impression on the part of the disciples that whatever happened, we can't figure out what happened because we're getting conflicting accounts here of what transpired. In any case, the disciples don't believe the women. For the most part, they don't. But Peter and John are intrigued enough about this report that they go to the tomb to check it out. Okay? So they run to the tomb. They see the empty tomb. And they marvel at what they have seen. John, in his gospel, tells them that he, John, believed. That when he saw the empty tomb, he somehow put it all together and he believed that Jesus was raised from the dead. Now, when Peter and John ran to the tomb, Mary Magdalene at least, and in all likelihood, no, and we know that other women had to have gone along with her, they tag along behind Peter and John. And they arrive at the tomb again for a second time after Peter and John have gone to the tomb and seen it empty and left. They arrive again. Now Mary Magdalene once again, she once again goes into the empty tomb. This time she sees two angels. She had only seen one angel before. This time she sees two angels in the empty tomb. The angels ask her why she's weeping, why she's crying. As she's talking with the angels, she turns and she's face to face with Jesus, but she doesn't recognize him as Jesus. She thinks that he's the gardener. Thinking that he's the gardener, she asks him, "Where have you taken the Lord? Where have you taken his body?" And at that point, Jesus confronts her and reveals himself to her, and it becomes clear that it's Jesus. And Jesus says, "Don't cling to me. You must not cling to me," which I don't think he means by that. I don't think he means don't touch her. I think what he means by that is, I'm not going to be here long, so don't count on me being around, because he knows that he's going to depart. At that point, Mary Magdalene and the other women with her go back again to the upper room. Before, they had only seen the empty tomb. Now they have seen the risen Jesus. So, of course, that's worth reporting again. So they go back into the city to where the disciples are gathered to report that they have seen Jesus and to report what Jesus instructed her to tell them. Sometime while all of this is going on, the Sanhedrin meets. They agree to bribe the guards at the tomb to lie about the events of the morning and to deflect the claim that that Jesus is risen by spreading the story that the body has been stolen. The events go on, but I'm going to stop the chronology about right there. So with that in mind, let's look at the various accounts here quickly. I'm looking first at Matthew. That's in chapter 27, verse 57. The thing to recognize about Matthew's account is Matthew is telling the story from the standpoint of the second group of women who go to the tomb. He doesn't even mention anything about the first group of women. So it's Mary Magdalene, and I think he mentions the other Mary. And when we know that there are other women with them, but it's from the standpoint of these two probably inseparable friends that he is going to tell their story. That's the important thing to recognize in these gospel accounts. These gospel accounts are the stories of particular people. And depending upon what people are having their story told, the events may vary from account to account because the people had different experiences. Well, this is the account of Mary Magdalene and the other Mary. But we'll start with the burial, verse 57 of chapter 27. When it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who himself had also become a disciple of Jesus. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate ordered it to be given to him. And Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn out in the rock. And he rolled a large stone against the entrance of the tomb and went away. And Mary Magdalene was there, and the other Mary, sitting opposite the grave. Now on the next day, the day after the preparation, by the preparation they mean the day before a Sabbath, is always called the day of preparation. That's where you prepare the meals that you must eat during the Sabbath, because you can't work on the Sabbath, and various other things. Now on the next day, the day after the preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered together with Pilate and said, "Sir, we remember that when he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days, I am to rise again.'" So this is Friday that this is happening. "Therefore, give orders for the grave to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal him away and say to the people, 'He is risen from the dead,' and the last deception will be worse than the first." Pilate said to them, "You have a guard. Go, make it as secure as you know how." So the Sanhedrin uses their own temple guard to guard the tomb. And they went and made the grave secure, and along with the guard, they set a seal on the stone. Now, after the Sabbath, now this is a different Sabbath. If we didn't know the whole picture and didn't know the whole story, we may very well think that the Sabbath was the same Sabbath that that followed the crucifixion. But we already know that there's a next day, verse 62, in between these Sabbaths. So unless Matthew doesn't know what he's talking about, this can't be the same Sabbath because there's a next day in between. This Sabbath is the day after the day after the first Sabbath. This is the weekly Sabbath. Now, after the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary, this is their experience, their story being told, came to look at the grave. And behold, a severe earthquake. Now, Matthew inserts something that is not concurrent with Mary and the other Mary coming to the tomb. He's explaining what it is that they are about to encounter and to see. This is a retrospective. He's going back in time. Now, behold, a severe earthquake had occurred, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled away the stone and sat upon it. And his appearance was like lightning, and his clothing as white as snow. The guards shook for fear of him and became like dead men. That's the end of the retrospective. How does anyone know about that? Probably an eyewitness who was one of the guards. Maybe one of those guards became in time a disciple of Jesus and told their story. We don't really know, but only the guards would have been eyewitnesses to this event. So probably they are the source of this retrospective account. Now, having inserted that retrospective, he now returns to the main theme of what Mary and the other Mary, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary experienced. That angel who sat on the stone when he had rolled it away with the guards, that angel said to the women when they arrived at the tomb, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus who has been crucified. He is not here, for he has risen, just as he said, 'Come, see the place where he was lying. Go quickly and tell his disciples that he has risen from the dead, and behold, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Behold, I have told you.' And they left the tomb quickly with fear and great joy and ran to report it to his disciples." Okay, now what intervenes between 8 and 9 is them going to the disciples, just like Matthew says. They go to the disciples and they report to them, but Mary and Magdalene have returned to the tomb. And we, as I reconstructed, they follow John and Peter back to the tomb. Matthew doesn't tell us all that. He's telling their story of their encounter with the empty tomb and with Jesus. That is, for the standpoint of Matthew's purposes, an irrelevant detail. The fact of the matter is, they see the empty tomb, they go report it to the disciples, and the next important thing that happens in their lives is their encounter with Jesus, and that's what Matthew now goes on to report. "Now behold, Jesus met them and greeted them, and they came up and looked, took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, 'Do not be afraid. Go and take word to my brethren to leave for Galilee, and there they will see me.'" That's the end of that account. Now, Matthew wants us to know that concurrently with all of that, the guards that who've had their own experience with the angel, he goes back to their story. "Now, while they were on their way," that is, while all this was happening with the women and the angels, "now, while they were on their way, some of the guard came into the city and reported to the chief priests all that had happened. And when they had assembled with the elders and consulted together, they gave a large sum of money to the soldiers and said, 'You are to say, his disciples came by night and stole him away while he was asleep. And if this should come to the governor's ears, we will win him over and keep you out of trouble.' And they took the money and did as as they had been instructed, and this story was widely spread among the Jews and is to this day. Okay, I'll end. That's where Matthew ends his account of this part of the story. Now we look at Mark. This is Mark 15, starting with verse 42. When evening had already come, because it was the preparation day, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea came, a prominent member of the council, who himself was waiting for the kingdom of God, and he gathered up courage and went in before Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Pilate wondered if he was dead by this time, and summoning the centurion, he questioned him as to whether he was already dead. In ascertaining this from the centurion, he granted the body to Joseph. Joseph bought a linen cloth, took him down, wrapped him in the linen cloth, and laid him in a tomb which had been hewn out in the rock, and he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joses, were looking on to see where he was laid. When the Sabbath was over, several days, we're now on the other side of the weekly Sabbath. Why does Mark not tell us that this time is span? It's not relevant to his purposes. It doesn't really matter. He reports that they had seen where Jesus was buried, and the next important thing that happens is they are going to that location to prepare him for burial. When does that happen? The day after the weekly Sabbath, on Sunday morning. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, and Salome, so notice we have Salome as a part of this group here, bought spices so that they might come and anoint him. Very early on the first day of the week, they came to the tomb when the sun had risen. They were saying to one, when the Sabbath was over, I misspoke here. The Sabbath that was over was the first Sabbath. And then the next day, these three women bought spices. Now we skip over the next Sabbath that comes after they have done that, and now we're very early on the first day of the week. Very early on the first day of the week, they came to the tomb when the sun had risen. They were saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb?" Looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled away, although it was extremely large. Okay, now, this is Mary Magdalene and the other Mary. It may be Salome, but actually all we know about Salome is that she helped buy the spices the day before. She may very well have been a part of the first group of women who wasn't involved in carrying all these heavy spices. So the only ones we know for sure in this second group are Mary and the other Mary. Well, This story now is told from their experience. This is their account. Looking up, Mary and the other Mary saw that the stone had been rolled away, although it was extremely large. Entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting at the right, wearing a white robe, and they were amazed. And he said to them, "Do not be amazed. You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene, who has been crucified. He has risen. He is not here. Behold, here is the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." They went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had gripped them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. And now the Greek manuscripts of the ending of Mark become very, very difficult to know which is the original, so I'm going to break it off here. I don't even know what the text is after this point for sure. It's not a study that I've made. But if we were to compare, Matthew and Mark are giving the account of the same group of people. And I would argue that if you go compare Matthew and Mark, there are no incompatibilities between what Matthew says went down and what Mark says went down. They include different details. Mark tells us things that Matthew doesn't tell us, but the things that Matthew tells us are not at all incompatible with what Matthew has told us. Now, when we come to Luke, we're in Luke 23. Luke is going to give us a different account. It's not going to be compatible with what Matthew and Mark gave us. But what I'm going to argue is the account that Luke is giving us is an account of a different group of women. The group of women that whose account Luke is recording for us is that first group of women, the women who outpaced Mary and the other Mary, got to the tomb first, encountered two angels instead of one, and were instructed by those two angels, and then left and departed as the other women were arriving. So we start in Luke 23:50. And a man named Joseph, who was a member of the council, a good and righteous man, he had not consented to their plan and action, a man from Arimathea, a city of the Jews, who was waiting for the kingdom of God. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. And he took it down and wrapped it in a linen cloth and laid him in a tomb cut into the rock where no one had ever lain. It was the preparation day, and the Sabbath was about to begin. Now, this is Wednesday before the Sabbath of the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, the women who had come with him out of Galilee, Luke doesn't tell us which women they are, but just some women who had come out of Galilee, followed and saw the tomb and how his body was laid. Then they returned and prepared spices and perfumes. They did that the day after the Sabbath that was about to come. And on the Sabbath day, the weekly Sabbath, they rested according to the commandment. So they prepared the spices, then intervenes the weekly Sabbath, they rest on the Sabbath day, and now finally we arrive at Sunday morning. But on the first day of the week, at early dawn, they came to the tomb bringing the spices which they had prepared. All of the women are setting out on the mission of bringing these spices to prepare the body. They begin as one group, but by the time they arrive at the tomb, they are split into two groups. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb. Now, Luke is going to tell us the experience of the eyewitnesses of these women who are part of the first group. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb, but when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were perplexed about this, behold, two men suddenly stood near them in dazzling clothing. Notice that's a different experience than Matthew and Mark, where we are only dealing with one angel confronting them. Two men suddenly stood near them in dazzling clothing, and as the women were terrified and bowed their faces to the ground, the men said to them, "Why do you seek the living one among the dead? He is not here, but he is risen. Remember how he spoke to you while he was still in Galilee, saying that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified, and the third day rise again." And they remembered his words and returned from the tomb and reported all these things to the 11 and to all the rest. Then Luke goes on to say, now they were Mary Magdalene. Now who are the they? The they here in 10 are the people who returned from the tomb and reported all these things to the 11 and to all the rest. All of the women have come together as a group to report what has happened to the 11 hiding out in the room. So he's just giving us now a list of by name of some of the prominent women who are reporting what they have been eyewitness to, the empty tomb. It includes Mary Magdalene and Mary, the other Mary, Mary the mother of James. These are prominent women among the disciples, but not because that's the story that Luke has just reported. They didn't have that experience. They had a different experience. But they are a part of the group of women who are reporting what their experiences of the empty tomb were. So now they were Mary Magdalene and Joanna, who is probably a part of the other group, and Mary the mother of James. Also the other women with them were telling these things to the apostles. But these words appeared to them as nonsense, and they would not believe them. But Peter got up and ran to the tomb. We know from John that it's Peter and John, but Luke only records Peter. Peter got up and ran to the tomb, stooping and looking in. He saw the linen wrappings only, and he went away to his home, marveling at what had happened. Okay, so Luke is actually telling us this, a story of a different group of women, I would argue. Now we go to John, finally, and starting with 19, verse 38. After these things, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but a secret one for fear of the Jews, ask Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate granted permission. So he came and took away his body. Nicodemus, who had first come to him by night, also came, bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds weight. So they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen wrappings with the spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews. Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new tomb in which no one had ever yet had been laid. Therefore, because of the Jewish day of preparation, since the tomb was nearby, they laid Jesus there. So John tells us about the burial of Jesus. He skips over several days now, and the next thing John is going to tell us about is Sunday morning, the empty tomb. Now on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came early to the tomb. This whole account is strictly given as if it's Mary Magdalene's experience and only hers. We know from the other accounts that other women were along with her in various intersections in her story. Now, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came early to the tomb while it was still dark and saw the stone already taken away from the tomb. So she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple. Notice that John doesn't even tell us about seeing any angel or any instructions from any angel. All he tells us is she came early in the morning and saw the stone already taken away from the tomb. John doesn't even tell us that she looked in to see if the tomb was empty. It's obvious from John's account that she did, though, because notice what she says to Simon Peter. So she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple, that's John, whom Jesus loved, and said to them, "They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." Obviously, she had to look in the tomb to find out that his body wasn't there. So John is omitting some details that are included in the other accounts, but what he's saying is not at all incompatible with that. She went to the tomb. The stone was rolled away. She looked and saw that the tomb was empty. In fact, an angel told her so, but John doesn't report that. She runs back to where John and Peter and the other disciples are and tells all the other disciples, but John is telling this story from his own standpoint as the other disciple whom Jesus loved. He's giving his story now. He and Peter then run back to the tomb, as John will tell us here. So she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved and said to him, "They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." So Peter and the other disciple went forth, and they were going to the tomb. The two were running together, and the other disciple ran ahead faster than Peter and came to the tomb first. And stooping and looking in, he saw the linen wrappings lying there, but he did not go in. And so Simon Peter also came, following him, and entered the tomb, and he saw the linen wrappings lying there, and the face cloth which had been on his head, not lying with the linen wrappings, but rolled up in a place by itself. So the other disciple who had first come to the tomb, this is John, then also entered, and he saw and believed. For as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise again from the dead. So the disciples went away again to their own homes. But Mary was standing outside the tomb. Well, we can see from John's account, Mary has gone to tell Simon, Peter, and John. We know from the other accounts that they're not standing outside the empty tomb. She doesn't just step outside the tomb to tell them. She runs all the way into Jerusalem to tell them. So what is she doing standing outside the tomb right now? Obviously, she's returned. And I think she returned by simply following Peter and John back. And if John outran Peter, Peter probably outran Mary. They didn't dress for running in those days. But Mary was standing outside the tomb weeping, and as she wept, she stooped and looked into the tomb. And she saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and one at the feet, where the body of Jesus had been lying. Now, these are two angels this time, but they're not sitting on the rock. They're not standing inside the tomb. They're sitting at the place where Jesus had lain. So it's an entirely different event than the ones described in the earlier ones. She saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and one at the feet where the body of Jesus had been lying. And they said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "Because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." When she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there and did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him in Hebrew, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said to her, "Stop clinging to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brethren and say to them, I ascend to my Father and your Father, and my God and your God." Mary Magdalene came announcing to the disciples, "I have seen the Lord," and that he had said these things to her. And I'll stop the account there. But John, once again, is returning to the account of Mary Magdalene, just as Matthew and Mark had given us, except that John gives us, in some respects, a much more abbreviated account, and in other respects, includes all kinds of details that Matthew and Mark did not. But Matthew, Mark, and John are completely compatible with one another, that you can put them in a coherent way that makes perfectly good sense. Luke is telling a different story. Okay, 5 minutes for any questions you might have. While you're thinking of that, I just want to comment on one thing. If my chronology is right, notice how remarkable this is. Take Mary Magdalene, and I'm not picking on Mary Magdalene, because Mary Magdalene's story is the story of every one of Jesus' disciples. Mary Magdalene has seen the empty tomb, has had angels tell her that Jesus has risen, has gone back to tell the disciples that that's the case, is met with resistance, which may partly explain the phenomenon that I'm about to describe, has gone back to tell the disciples, has run back to the tomb. The tomb is still empty. She encounters two angels who tell her that Jesus has risen from the dead. Notice her conversation with the angels. They've taken the body, and I don't know where they've laid it. And the angels say, well, that's because he's risen. She turns and sees Jesus, thinks him to be the gardener, and says, "Where'd you put the body?" I mean, how many times do you need to be told, "Look, dude, he's not here, he's risen," before you actually believe it? Well, in every case, with all of the disciples, several times. It was just such a remarkable, unbelievable, implausible event that even when they're told straight out by angels themselves that Jesus has risen, they don't believe it. And we mustn't think that we wouldn't have done the same thing. I mean, we would be that dull-witted as well, because this was unprecedented. I mean, it's easy to have an encounter with an angel and to rationalize in your own head. You're trying to make sense of your experience. You're trying to make sense of reality. You're trying to make sense of your worldview and everything that you believe. And one thing you believe is people don't just pop up from the dead. They just don't. So you're trying to make sense out of this. And I don't know what stories they told themselves, but things like, well, those weren't really angels. I must have been seeing things. Maybe it was really an angel, but maybe I misheard. I mean, it's easy enough to tell yourself that you didn't encounter what you actually encountered, that you didn't experience what you just experienced, that you didn't hear what you just heard. And we're all capable of doing that. And we will try to do that, because we want to bring some coherence to our worldview. And as John himself told us in that, they as yet had not believed that he would raise from the dead. John was saying, until I saw the empty tomb, I wasn't expecting this. Well, Jesus had told them. And we saw on several occasions in the Gospel of Luke, how many times did Jesus sit down and say, okay, guys, just so we're clear here, I'm going to go into Jerusalem, they're going to arrest me, they're going to crucify me, they're going to bury me, on the third day I'm going to raise from the dead. Right? You got that? Yeah, right. I mean, they had been told, they understood, and it still was implausible to them. So John himself tells us, we just didn't believe it, you know? That just didn't make any sense to us. And until I entered the tomb and saw the tomb empty, John, from his own perspective, is saying, I hadn't believed it, but I believed it then. And it may very well be from the accounts that John was the first to get it. He was the first one to actually register. I see a resurrection has happened here. Time for your questions or comments.
Question. Mm-hmm. So there is no Good Friday.
That's true.
It's a Good Wednesday.
Exactly. That's right.
And the Sabbath after the crucifixion, you said, was the Sabbath of what?
The first day of the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread come right together. First is the Passover, and then the next day begins the Feast of the Unleavened Bread for 8 days. And the first of those 8 days is a Sabbath, and the eighth day of that festival is a Sabbath. So you have, within 9 days, you have three Sabbath days.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's that is the problem with studying your Bible. It really kind of wrecks Easter and Christmas. Because almost all of our hymns and Christmas carols don't have their facts straight. But they're still wonderful. I mean, I still sing Christmas carols.
So regardless of how you reconstruct the accounts or how you harmonize them, there's one fact that's pretty obvious to me, which is that they're very difficult to harmonize and very difficult to resolve. And why is that? I mean, if it's the case that the historical sequence of events is really crucial in order to guarantee that the events occurred, then why is it written in such a way that it's so hard to understand?
Well, it's a natural result of having people tell you stories. I was teaching a class on biblical inerrancy, and just as an experiment in this class, Jody and I had a rather eventful vacation the summer before I was teaching this class. So I wrote four different accounts of our vacation. Every one of them was absolutely accurate and reliable. It's something that I could very well have written out for somebody to tell them the story of my vacation. And then I gave people slips of paper saying, assume that these accounts are all inerrant and reconcile them. Some of them got a slip of paper that saying these may or may not be inerrant, you figure it out. And another group I gave the instructions, assume that these are irreconcilable accounts. And the argument that ensued, it was precious. It was absolutely precious because it paralleled exactly the arguments that people have about the New Testament accounts, the gospel accounts. You know, people saying, oh, yeah, you can reconcile it that way, but look at the mental gymnastics that you have to go through to make that come out right. I mean, there's just no way. That's just simply not what happened. For example, I'll give you an example. In order to reconcile the accounts, the only way you could reconcile the accounts is if my parents traveled from Eugene to Ashland to say goodbye to us as we left what must have been 1 o'clock in the morning in order to drive to San Jose, California to arrive in time. And the people who are recognizing that's the only way you could possibly reconcile the accounts is saying, come on, I mean, give me a break. How plausible is that? That Jack's parents travel from Eugene to Ashland in order to say goodbye to them? Yeah, right. Well, that's exactly what happened. We were going to go to a play in Ashland, and my parents drove from Eugene to Ashland to babysit for us so that we could go to the play. And then we left in the wee hours of the morning and drove on all night in order to arrive in San Jose the next morning. Well, that's actually what happened. Well, from the standpoint of people looking at these accounts, that seems so implausible that you must be engaging in some kind of strange mental gymnastics just to make these accounts reconcilable and harmonize them. Well, events really are that complicated. Implausible things really do happen. Weird things really do happen. So, and anytime you give an account of something that you have been eyewitness to, you're always selective about what details you will and will not include. And it's that selectivity that makes room for apparent obvious discrepancies between the two accounts. So I dare say that if you had four eyewitness testimonies of any event that has any complexity to it at all, you're going to have accounts that have problems between them, apparent discrepancies between them.
But not actual discrepancies.
But not actual, exactly.
But in the example that you gave of the exercise that you did with your students, you were, in a sense, intentionally trying to mislead them, because what you were trying to do is make it confusing to reconstruct what occurred.
Well, that is true, but you'd have to go back and look at my accounts. What I would argue, though, is that I didn't have to work at it. You know, I didn't have to, you know, kind of do things to trick them. I simply had to give the account as if I were writing to one group of people for one purpose, and then do it again as if I were writing it for a different purpose to a different group of people, slightly different group of people. And it was easy. I mean, I didn't even really have to work at it. It just automatically caused problems in the very process of doing that.
I think the difficulty we have is we didn't grow up in the Jewish culture, so I don't think most of us, or at least I'll speak for my, I didn't know there was two Passovers.
Right.
And I don't think, I would dare say, I would guess 99% of the world doesn't know that either.
Right.
So is that why all the people from all the different other regions came into Jerusalem, because of the basically the 9 days?
Yeah, the Passover and Feast of Unleavened Bread.
That's why they would come in? Is that just sort of once a year?
That's why Simon the Cyrene, who carries the cross of Jesus, who lives in North Africa, that's why he's in Jerusalem.
And that's just a once-a-year event. They don't have anything else like that.
I'm sorry?
They didn't have any other types of events like that throughout the year?
No, they did. There are two major festivals that they would come to Jerusalem for, and then some more minor ones. Yeah. But Passover was a huge one. Yeah.
It sounds to me like what you did with the Bible study group was you broke them into four groups. Is that right?
Three.
Three groups, and you gave them a bias.
Well, one group I didn't give a bias to. The other two I biased.
So two groups you gave a bias, a preconception, an assumption that they were allowed to hold to regardless of the evidence.
I did this twice. The second time I did it, I didn't bias anyone, and the same thing happened. Yeah.
So we create our own biases, and we... Have you ever read Stranger in a Strange Land by Heinlein? It's a
no.
Obscure science fiction.
Yep.
There's a character he creates in that book called The Witnesses, and they are people who are from childhood raised to be acute observers, very clear, and their word becomes legally admissible testimony. And I think that's my example of the way we should be, because they ask, as an example, they ask this witness, they're up on a hill, the pool, and they go, what color is that house down there? And the witness just glances over and says, it's white on this side. I mean, every time they try to catch him and trick him, he just gives a real clear, succinct, short answer that's all I know. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that these accounts aren't written to be reconciled. Each one is written individually to tell this version of the story, and, you know, leave it to the scholars 100 years later to sit down and try to draw out the...
Exactly, yeah. That's part of what I'm trying to say in answer to David, is that each one of the accounts is self-contained from the standpoint of the intention and purposes of its author. And he's not thinking, how can I reconcile this with somebody else's account? He's not even aware that that's even an issue. So whenever you do that, you're going to end up with those kinds of discrepancies. Because I don't care how keen an observer you are, a person who had an absolutely infallible memory for every little particular detail of an event, whenever they tell the account of that event, is going to omit details. You can't give an exhaustive account of everything you know. Why would you? Not all of it's relevant to your purposes. So your purposes control what level of detail and which details you do and do not include. I've got to let you go. Thank you.